Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, the managing editor of news at WCAI. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Anne.
Morning, Sean.
Joining us a little later will be Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Jim DeRuiter will be calling in from the New Bedford Standard Times, where he's the editorial page editor. Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner, will call in, and as will Jeff Spillane, the reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise. And Nelson Siegelman will call in. He's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. So let's find out what's been happening on the Cape, the coast, and the islands. And we saw our headline this week, big plans for a development in Buzzards Bay.
Right. This would be right on the canal, just across from the town hall in Bourne Town Hall on Perry Avenue. It calls for a they're calling it a destination-type development that calls for a mixed-use complex that would be residential, retail, and also hotel and conference space.
And we're talking about the other side of the bridge, the Buzzards Bay part of the bridge. Okay. And so that's an area that's had some troubles over the years. Been a lot of revitalization efforts there before.
Right. I've seen so many revitalization efforts on that part.
Yeah.
It was a very popular spot when the military base was active duty. There were a lot more people around. But the nail in the coffin really came with the Route 25 bypass. I don't know if people remember how you used to have to get to the Cape. You'd have to take Route 6 through Wareham. And once the bypass came up, that really really hurt that area economically. And it's been struggling over the years. One of the things, the Marine Life Center was supposed to be something that would revitalize the area. Even the Marine Life Center has struggled. So they're looking at this destination. I like to call them kind of the Main Street Disneyland towns that kind of come up, like Mashpee Commons. And, you know, it was a field, and now it's a real downtown-looking type development.
Yeah.
And this is kind of what they have in mind down there. It would be overlooking the canal, so there would be wonderful views. And it's 4 to 7 stories. The first phase, like I said, would be residential and retail. And a second phase would be the hotel and conference center. And just to add something, one of the things that is changing at this point is the possibility that commuter rail may be coming into Buzzards Bay as well.
That is exciting. Any response from town officials at all?
Well, there is concern on the part of a couple of selectmen who also sit on the sewer board. The town, part of Bourne, has a contract with Wareham to process wastewater. They're agreement is that they will process about 200,000 gallons of wastewater from Buzzards Bay area. And this new development, the first phase, is going to need 30,000 gallons a day of wastewater. That's bumping up against the capacity that the town has with Wareham. If they give this, this 30,000 to go with this new development, then the town only has about 12 to 15 thousand gallons left in their capacity to deal with wastewater. So there are some fears that if they give this big chunk to this one development first phase, that then other Main Street businesses might not be able to put in improvements. But for this response at a meeting earlier this week of the Sewer Commission was kind of confusing to people like Chris Bailey, who is a broker with Commercial Realty Advisors, who has been working with the town apparently to locate a place where they could build a wastewater treatment facility. They're looking at a private-public partnership to do that, and that would have to be in place if the second phase of this development was going to be built. So Chris Bailey was a little confused, knowing that this is going on, but also part of the development plan. So we'll have to see. There were no decisions made. It's just people talking about the wastewater capacity, as well as is a 7-story building what we really want sitting on the Cape Cod Canal. Does that fit with the seaside flavor of the area?
I see. One of the stories, the big talker story this week, all over social media about the National Seashore banning smoking at its beaches.
Right. This involves 6 beaches that have lifeguards lifeguards protecting the beaches, and other seashore beaches are open to smokers. But what the seashore superintendent, George Price, said is that, you know, more than a million people come to these beaches every year. And he's been getting a lot of complaints from beachgoers who, you know, the beaches are crowded. Your towel or blanket may be closer to the person next to you. And if you're not a smoker and they are, it could impact the person's experience and health. And they're not the first to do this. Yarmouth, East Ham has a no smoking policy at its public beaches. So does Yarmouth, Falmouth, and Barnstable. But, you know, there are people saying, is this going too far?
I didn't see a lot of those comments. I'm sure those people are out there, smokers who say, well, I'm outside. But most of the comments I saw were supportive, and most of them were on the Cape Cod Times story website. Actually, I think there were hundreds of responses
right.
at one point. Okay, let's talk about it. There's a poacher problem, and we've touched upon this a little bit throughout the year. I wasn't aware of this, but there really seems to be a market for these eels. They're very small, translucent eels that are in this area, and people have been stealing them. And boy, these things are worth a lot of money.
Right. These are baby eels, or they're at the glass eel stage. Like you said, they're see-through.
Uh-huh.
And there are only two states in the country that allow fishermen to catch these, the elvers, or what they're also called, if they're less than 6 inches long. And then Maine and South Carolina are those two states. These just... By way of background, these eels are born in the Sargasso Sea and make their way back to Cape Cod and other places along the Atlantic coast and make their way into ponds.
I don't know where the Sargasso Sea is, do you?
Down by Bermuda.
Okay, thanks.
And they make their way into ponds around here, and then they stay like 8 to 20 years before they head back to the Sargasso Sea to mate and have children. So that's a long lifespan. So if you're taking the young out of a population by poaching them and not protecting them, the stocks are not going to last long. And in fact, eel is very popular for sushi and other things in Asia. And the eel populations there have been fished out. And once that happened around 2012, the price for these elvers can be as much as $2,500 a pound.
That's amazing. And there was a story a few weeks ago, and it was referenced in this week's story in the Times, about two alleged poachers in Falmouth trying to walk away with 35 pounds. So if I do some math, I think, you know, I'm
a
journalist.
$28,000 or so.
Is that what you got? Because I got a lot more than that.
No, that's what it was in the story.
Oh, okay.
So...
I'll better check my math.
Your math is probably correct. Anyway, it is a lot of money. And the thing is that because of this, the call for licenses and doing the fishing in the states where it's legal has pushed people out. Not everybody can get the licenses. And so we have poachers coming down to Massachusetts. In fact, I believe it was those two, or there was another person who was taken into custody for poaching, who said that he was one of a pair of people who that there were several pairs of people dropped off around Cape Cod to fish for these eels, and that they would be picked up and then be taken back to Maine.
Wow.
And they came down from Maine.
A conspiracy.
So, because Maine, all the licenses are taken. It's too crowded. People can't get to the fish. But Maine, there are things that are in place. One is the one in Falmouth that you referenced. The police got a tip from somebody who thought these two men looked suspicious and thought maybe they were poaching and called the police. In another case, the environmental police are now trying to be more vigilant. They can't be everywhere, but they are really sitting and watching different places for these poachers. And Sarah Peek now wants to has a bill before the legislature that would increase the maximum fine for poachers from $1,000 to $10,000.
Well, that would make sense. I mean, if the fine's only $1,000, you're getting $2,500 per pound. seems like that fine needs to be ratcheted up a bit.
Right. And there was a man from Maine who was caught in Harwichport who went to court, and his fine was almost $500, which is much higher than the $50 that used to be the fine that used to be generally given out for this. So Maine also has an electronic tracking system now with eels. So if the eels don't show up in this electronic tracking, it's hard to sell them. And so that's really cut the amount of poaching cases. But these fish often are sent to Asia where they're raised on farms, and a pound of elvers can translate into $20,000 a pound of
When they grow?
Meat, yeah,
of
quality eel meat. So.
I see. Let's talk about another story that's really burning up the internet. It's about this Mill Hill Club in Yarmouth. I never had the experience of being there. I understand it had quite a heyday in the 70s and the 80s, though it goes back to the 50s. WCAI's Brian Morris was there. He did a really nice story for us. You can find that at capeandislands.org. Also, your two fellas over there at the Cape Cod Times, Cape Cast, did an excellent little video piece with just people commenting about their experiences at the Mill Hill Club. And of course, the story is it's now gone.
And it was, like you say, just to move the story along here, it was torn down to make way for a new facility that will for people who are suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia. But according to our reporting, the building was built in 1910. It was a restaurant in the 20s through the 40s, when I think it closed for financial reasons. And then in the 50s and 60s, it became kind of an upscale bar. And in the 70s, it took kind of a more rock and roll. Jazz.
Maybe some disco in there.
Disco, yeah, depending on what. Well, B.B. King was there. There were other bands, the Hennessy Brothers, Roundhouse, and it was a real hot spot. And it was at a time where there were several clubs on Cape Cod that were kind of this rock and roll disco, like you say, mm-hmm. Around the Cape. And this really is one of the last, if not the last, to be gone. I mean, it closed its doors in 2008. It really... once the 90s, mid-90s hit, it wasn't what it had been in the 70s and 80s, where you had huge lines to get in. There were always noise complaints and, the neighbors complaining. But, a lot of people remember their 20-somethings, spending their 20-somethings at the Mill Hill in the summertime. And in the wintertime, if you're local, we put a question on Facebook asking people to share their memories. And several people said they met their husband or their wife there. And so one of my favorites was memories. Yes, some good, some bad, some very, very fuzzy.
Someone was saying talking about how fun it was inside, and then they were talking about it was pretty much just as fun at the parking lot after it closed as well. Some great stories out of that.
I never saw Frank Santos, the R-rated hypnotist, though.
He's been around for a long time, huh? Let's briefly go to this story that we've been following for what seems like years. Here is Mary Ellen Johnson. She's the former superintendent in the town of Sandwich, and she had taken the town to court because saying, look, my contract was breached, and the judge found that it was, and he awarded her, I think it was $430,000. But she kept going back to court. Tell us about that.
Well, this judgment that came out was, she claims her attorney, she had originally sued for $2.9 million based on she had 5 years on her contract. She was making about $180,000 a year and sick and other perks that she had. So when her attorney agreed to this $434,000, she claimed that he never asked her. He just made the deal. And since then, she has made several attempts to try and get the judge to reopen the case and look at the cost. In addition to the $434,000 of that, she's got to pay $165,000 in legal fees to her attorney. So she didn't have much luck in her subsequent attempts during the winter to get the judge to reopen and relook at the settlement. And so she fired her attorney and then represented herself, and that she hired a couple of new lawyers. They went before the court, and the judge, not only did he say, I am not opening this up, but now you are going to have to pay the town's legal fees, because there was warning that if you continue to pursue this, that there'll be financial implications.
Hmm. Does she have any more options?
Well, she can appeal this ruling of having to pay legal fees. There is a chance of appeal. And if the judge, well, she has 10 days to file that brief, and she has to pay 20 days. She has 20 days to pay the legal fees. The town didn't have those fees available at the time we talked to them.
And of course, this all began when she had her contract renewed by the school committee in Sandwich, and then some new members were elected. They reopened that vote again, and they did not renew it, the second vote. And so she found that was...
Right. And what happened, she'd had a bumpy relationship and, you know, and she, I think, became part of the school committee election. So prior to the election, they voted a 2-year extension to her contract. The school committee did. There was a question whether that had been posted properly. And then when the new two new members joined the school committee, who were not in her Mary Ellen Johnson's camp, they revoted, saying that the posting was incorrect, and they then denied the contract extension. And then
it came down to a question of the open meeting law.
Right.
And so
but the judge found that the contract was breached.
Absolutely.
So.
He did. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Joshua Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone, Joshua Balling, the Assistant Editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the Director of Digital Content at the paper. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Tell us about this 100-acre site that the town is pursuing for open space.
It's about 100 acres out on the west end of the island in Mattaket, formerly owned by the Federal Aviation Administration and declared surplus property a couple years ago, now under the oversight of the General Services Administration. And the town officials and island conservation groups are partnering together to attempt to buy this and preserve it as open space. It was formerly eyed as a potential site for a West End wastewater treatment plant, but a decision was made earlier this year not to build that plant and instead to pump the town's wastewater from out there to the existing wastewater plant. Mm. But town officials, conservation groups decided anyway to continue to pursue the property, keep it as open space, and protect the watershed and prohibit further development out there. It's formerly zoned in a 3-acre district and had the potential to be subdivided into about 30 decent-sized house lots, each with the potential for 2 dwellings, a main dwelling, and a guest house, but was last year rezoned into a more restrictive Moorlands district, which reduces the potential development to 9 lots and about 18 houses. But the town is hoping to acquire this property, protect it as open space. It has a diverse variety of ecotype groups and communities. It's regionally and globally rare plant species, a number of other threatened species out there, so town officials are hoping that they can work with the GSA and acquire this property for the town. No formal appraisal has been done yet. It actually has been done, but hasn't been released yet. And it's been assessed by the town at about $3.4 million.
Okay. We've also spoken about the Stop and Shop proposal in town, new Stop and Shop coming up supposedly to Nantucket, but that's been appealed now?
It has been appealed, so we're looking at least several months, if probably not more, in delays to the Mid-Island Stop and Shop expansion and relocation. A couple of neighbors, a Sparks Avenue couple across the street, just down the street from where the Stop and Shop hope to build, have appealed the planning board's approval of that expansion and relocation, arguing that it will lower their property values and adversely impact their quality of life. They filed the appeal in land court late last week. They live and own a business at 18A Sparks Avenue, just down the street from where Stop and Shop is hoping to demolish their current building, which they say is too small, the current supermarket, and build one on the other side of the property that's about 20% larger. The planning board approved it last month with relatively little public opposition. Some neighbors on the Sparks Avenue side did complain about it, but overall it was generally well-received. Most people feel that the Mid-Island needs a larger supermarket, so Stop and Shop officials say the same thing. Right now, it's probably going to be at least several months. Given the size of the project, it will probably be fast-tracked through the land court, but no court dates have yet been set. Stop and Shop officials this week had little to say about the appeal, just saying they're reviewing the documents and not going to say too much more. Now, Planning Board, Planning and Land Use Services Director Andrew Vorse says that he believes the board did an excellent job in its decision. They even went so far as to hire an outside consultant to review the potential traffic impact. But the appellants say that the project is just poorly thought out, that the decision will have adverse impacts on their property values, their enjoyment of the property, that there will be excessive noise and dust and glare, parking problems, a whole list of concerns they have. So it's going to look like it's going to work its way through the court system before anything happens.
Ann Brennan?
Josh, what is the shopping situation there, the shop supermarket situation? Is this... I just don't know how many stores you have over there for groceries.
We have two supermarkets, both owned by Stop and Shop. The Mid-Island supermarket is the larger of the two. It's about 32,000 square feet, much smaller than most Stop and Shops and certainly smaller than the Super Stop and Shops on the mainland. There's another Stop and Shop down on the downtown waterfront, which is even smaller than that, the former A&P and GU Family Market. Stop and Shop took over last year. And there are a number of other smaller groceries, farm stand types. Bartlett's Ocean View Farm, a lot of people know, has a large farm stand, really a small grocery. But those Stop and Shops are the only two supermarkets we have, and it's generally been acknowledged for the last 5 to 10 years at least, if not longer, that the Mid-Island supermarket, where the majority of year-round residents shop, is too small, needs to be renovated, needs to be expanded, and Stop and Shop's been considering a number of options in the Mid-Island for at least 5 to 10 years.
Another story in the paper this week is regarding a proposal to make some changes to the face of a historic neighborhood. Folks can go to the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror website to read that story or pick up the paper. That's even better. Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. You can follow Josh on Twitter, and I do that, at JBallingIM. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Ann Brennan is here in our Woods Hole studio. Ann, the FAIR plan, that is the insurance of last resort, and about 40% of Cape and Island homeowners are on that plan because so many homeowner insurance companies left Cape Cod. They were looking for a raise in the rates, as they seem to do every year. But they didn't get it this time, right?
No, they didn't. This was a proposal filed last year that would have increased Cape Cod insurance, home insurance rates for Cape and Islands residences 9.9%. Homeowner insurance rates in other parts of the state would have been about 6.8%. So the insurance commissioner, Joseph G. Murphy, in looking at this and taking testimony and everything, felt that the FAIR plan had not provided sufficient support documentation to prove that they needed this level of increase.
Okay. Joining us on the phone is Jim DeRuta. He's the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Tell us about the Dartmouth schools. They've lost four administrators?
Four top administrators in a system of about 3,400 students, and they've been making good progress with two schools at level one, and the high school scored at a point below level one, the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education's ranking system, one being the top. They've lost their superintendent, who's going to Portsmouth, Rhode Island, and to a system a little bit smaller, but for a little more money. They've lost their assistant superintendent. They've lost their special ed director, a much-loved special ed director with a few years of experience there, but they didn't renew her contract, and they've lost the high school principal.
My goodness. Did the school committee see this coming? Did this happen all at once? Have they anything in place?
The school committee has, and they don't have anything in place yet.
Have they started a search for a new superintendent?
No.
Oh, my.
And the outgoing superintendent has promised that she'll stick around long enough to make sure that process has begun. Oh. And this did kind of blindside them. The special ed director had created a little bit of a kerfuffle a couple months ago. Parents were upset, especially, you know, parents with special ed students who were very happy with the work that she'd done over several years, and they started going to the school committee and bringing up the issue, saying, why did this happen? Now, of course, personnel issues. Sometimes we never get to what the root reason is, but that was the only hint that they had, and they thought that maybe there was a little lack of communication between the administration and the school committee, but Now the superintendent has decided, much like a lot of school administrators, that the 3 years she's been there as superintendent, with 3 years as assistant superintendent before that, have satisfied the challenge she felt she had in Dartmouth, and she wants to move on to a new challenge.
We see this over and over again with school superintendents just staying a couple years and then going off someplace else for a little bit more money. Yes,
and in sandwich, Richard Canfield, who is the superintendent, it turns out he had applied for a job in Idaho and didn't get the job.
And a lot of
that
times
upset a lot of people.
Well, they come in. Oftentimes, they come in and they have big plans.
Exactly.
They have and they convince people to get on board to try to implement new programs. And then what happens is I'm not talking about Canfield in particular.
Right.
I'm just saying generally.
Right.
They walk away, and boy, that puts teachers without leaders and parents concerned about their children. That's a very good story. I encourage people to go to South Coast Today to read that story and find out what is happening in Dartmouth. And of course, Jim, tell us briefly, if you could, about the Cape Fishermen. Big news, $33 million in disaster relief coming for Cape Fishermen, but not everyone's happy or thinks it's being handled the right way.
Right. The $33 million that's coming to the Northeast fisheries has been split up into what the fishermen like to call three buckets. $11 million is going to be spread among the qualifying boat owners, and that means in Massachusetts there'll be about 100 boat owners getting $32,000 apiece. That will not necessarily and not likely trickle down to the crew members. There's a problem with this, because when the feds decided that they were going to send this money, they wanted to base it on the economic impact of the disaster, the fisheries disaster, and they counted the crew members. They counted small boats, and it's not making it to them. So there's still another $22 million, and out of those two buckets, each one about $11 million, one of them is going to New England states, $11 million to be split around New England states, but Massachusetts will get the lion's share, $8.2 million. Division of Marine Fisheries, the State Division of Marine Fisheries, is got to work together with a task force and come up with a way to divvy that up.
So there's still some hope that these smaller boats could get some of that.
Yes.
Okay.
And they should. I really think they should. Tax-paying crew members, their damages went into the calculation of this, and they should get it. And the small boats that haven't landed 5,000 pounds of ground fish over the past 4 years, their damages went into this calculation. That money is there for them. And then the last bucket is a buyback program that's to buy back permits. We talked with some fishermen the other day, and they said the likelihood of that being a very attractive offer to boat owners is a pretty low likelihood, and that there's going to be a lot of that buyback money left over, and they think it ought to be sent again in relief. Now, the other problem is that with this $32,000 that the feds are going to divvy up from that first bucket, they've already identified who's going to get the money. They already have the money, and now the money won't be sent out until at least October 1st. And the guys need help now.
Yeah, I understand. It can be a tough story to follow with a lot of numbers on the radio. So, again, I encourage... No, it's not you. It's an important story, and I understand your perspective on it as well as the perspective of the fishermen. I encourage people to go to the website to read that story and kind of get those numbers in hand. And Brennan had a question.
Well, it's not a question, just that the fishermen came in and talked to us as well. And the point they were making in the buyback is the buybacks, in their opinion, haven't worked. So why not take the money and use it for retraining? And so that's one of the things that they're looking at, because there's not enough fish out there, obviously. So instead of just using, get some value for the money.
I see.
Yes, and they also made the point to us, too, that this is the immediate issue, but the long-term issue is that they need to improve the whole regulatory system. And that they have to make it so that the fisheries can be sustainable, because there aren't as many fish. But we talked with a fellow who's a third-generation fisherman, and he says, I'm not exactly encouraging my children to go into fishing, but I want them to be able to if that's what they want to do.
Yeah, we've heard. Yes, understand. Okay, Jim DeRuta, the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. The fishing issue is so complex, and it's so emotional, really. It's so because of all the history and the family history, and it's such a difficult job, and demand is so high. You can follow Jim on Twitter, or at least the New Bedford Standard Times editorial page on Twitter, at OpinionSCT, and the SCT stands for South Coast Today, and that's the website, southcoasttoday.com, to get to the New Bedford Standard Times. There's another story in the paper this week you might want to check out. We don't have time to talk about it now, but there's an in-depth look into a food addict's recovery, an anonymous food addict's recovery system that's going on. Jim DeRuta, thank you very much.
You bet. Just will mention that if you check out foodaddicts.org, you can read about that as well as, of course, you can read the story online.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you, Jim. Sally Rose is on the phone. She is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hello, Sean.
And tell us, we've talked about the establishment of this Civic Engagement Committee. Remind us, what is it about, and have they started working yet?
Well, yes, they have. And so this is the committee that the selectmen decided to create after those big, deep divides, divisions broke open last year between the police and a good portion of the community. And, of course, you remember, Sean, it got quite severe last year and resulted in the police chief being fired and the town manager, she left for another job in the midst of all of that. Well, this 9-member Civic Engagement Committee, and it was formed at the recommendation of the Massachusetts Office of Public Collaboration. It met for the first time early this week, and it includes a variety of members of the public and also of the police department, business owners, people on boards, and just a nice mix. So its aim is to try to help the town heal those divisions, try to figure out ways to improve the discussion, improve the tenor of the discourse between townspeople and police, and also between townspeople and town government in general. So the themes were better communication, building trust, working together, and the committee agreed that, I guess, in the short term, they're going to find simple ways to start rebuilding that public trust with the police department, things that could be done easily during the summer months. Including just things like maybe having officers go in to introduce themselves to business owners through the town. Then they also decided to look for longer-term goals that they could do in the winter months. Interestingly, Sean, during this discussion, it came out that from the police officers' point of view, those that were participating in the meeting, people's attitudes were still negative toward police. But interestingly, most of the civilians think that things have gotten considerably better. Okay. They do think there's room for improvement, but they think it's gotten better. So that was an interesting differing perspective.
Okay. Tell us about the parking rates in town now. So when folks arrive in Provincetown, the rates are going up.
Yes. As of July 1st, they will go up. And that's at the parking lots around town. And several local business owners and business group leaders, they spoke out against these hikes, worried that they would deter tourism, especially day trippers, folks that come to visit just for the day, say from Upcape or from Boston. But selectmen nonetheless decided to go ahead with these recommendations, and these recommendations came from the Finance Committee. So what they are is basically the hourly rate for parking at like at McMillan Pier or the Grace Hall lot. They'll go up anywhere from 25 cents to 50 cents an hour, and this will go from May through September. The daily maximum charge also will go up for a 24-hour period. For example, in the McMillan part, that pier lot, that will go from $30 to $35. In the Grace Hall lot, which is only going up 25 cents an hour, that daily maximum charge will go from 20 to 25. So I think a lot of people feel that Provincetown has already too high rates and no free parking relative to other towns. So this was something that did bother a lot of business people and business organizations. So,
Sally, does that money go into the general fund, or does it go specifically for parking improvements and such?
No, it goes. It does go into the. It goes into the general fund and can be used for a variety of things. It will give the town an additional $200,000 to $250,000 in annual revenue.
Okay, Ann Brennan, you have a question.
You know, in Hyannis, they're actually doing similar in that they're taking what had been free parking is now going to be pay parking.
They're
putting in
yeah.
pay stations.
Oh, interesting.
So, right,
and the contractors are really upset about that, right? Because
right.
some of them park there as they travel over to the islands.
Right, and that's what the town administrators were saying. People are using these lots to go. Leave their cars there overnight or for a few days, and that's taking parking away from people who could be down in Main Street doing shopping okay. and enjoying the area.
Sure. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner, and she joins us each week. Thank you very much, Sally.
Thank you, Sean.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jeff Splane about what's happening in Mashpee. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. On the phone is Jeff Spillane. He's a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Sean. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Good morning. Big news this week, the resignation of a school committee member. We started this story last week when you told us about this school committee member went to one of the elementary schools in town and had a bad experience, and now she's resigned. Fill us in.
Yes, she has, and the member is Phyllis Sproud. She's been under fire since late May when she had that admitted meltdown at the elementary school, and she did finally resign on Wednesday afternoon, but this story had quite a few twists and turns during the week. It started out with the superintendent saying, hey, you know, this incident's been fully investigated and the families involved are satisfied. We then get a call from a parent who said, that's not the case. We have not heard from the superintendent and we're very upset about this and we are pursuing an investigation with the police. The next day, a recall effort was launched by a woman named Wanda Myers, who happens to be the wife of another school committee member. That was quite the talk of the town because recalls, as you know, are quite rare. And it would result in a special election being held, which would cost the taxpayers some money here in town. So there was a lot of buzz around that. And finally, on Wednesday, Phyllis did resign. She submitted a handwritten note to the town clerk. And when I say handwritten note, I mean that. It was like a piece of paper taken out of a notebook, similar to what probably we would write down our shopping list on.
Oh, my. How do they fill her position now?
Well, what will happen now will be a joint appointment by both the school committee and the Board of Selectmen. And I'm told this could take up to a month. They will solicit letters of interest from residents who would be interested in filling the position. There would be interviews held, and then a joint meeting between the Board of Selectmen and school committee would be held to select the board member.
So I think all of us are a little confused about what exactly this meltdown was. Do you have any clarity on that? And has it been confirmed that there's still an active police investigation, or have they wrapped things up?
No, it's still ongoing. I spoke with Rodney Collins, the Mashpee Chief of Police, last night, and he did confirm this continues to be an active investigation. I am expecting to hear one way or the other in the next few days how this turns out.
Okay. And any more clarity on what this meltdown was? Was it a raising of the voice? I know she admitted she might have poked a little girl in the stomach to make her breathe. I guess she was holding her breath, or at least that's what she's saying.
Right. Right now it's a she said versus child and teacher said. There is a debate over whether contact was made, whether it does constitute assault and battery. But yes, it does look like there was a very angry situation there on Phyllis's part.
I see. And Jeff, also you have a story this week there's a story in the Mashpee Enterprise about some good news for beachgoers.
Yeah, there's a beach in Mashpee, Callie's Beach, which is on the west end of South Cape Beach near Sedgelot Pond, and it's tucked into LaCroix Bay. And it's a beautiful beach. It's owned by the state, but for about the past 10 years, there's been limited access for the public to get to this beach. Reason being that the road that leads there, it's called Willswork Road, is in just deplorable condition with potholes and ruts and very, very difficult to pass through the road unless you have a monster truck or a heavy vehicle I'm 6'1", and went to take a look at the road the other day, and some of the potholes were up to my knees. So it is in horrible shape, and it's also a major safety concern. If something were to happen down there, the fire and the police could not get their vehicles there.
Oh.
They would have to respond by water. So we did hear some good news this week that the Mass DCR is sending 17 truckloads of gravel to Mashpee next week. And they are going to regrade the road to at least make it passable for this summer so that the public can enjoy the stay-at-home beach down there. And it will get us by until a more permanent solution can be implemented, which hopefully will be soon. I know that the legislators are working on a solution up in Boston right now.
Will people need a beach sticker to go to that beach?
They won't. That's one of the nice things about this. Well, it is a state part of the state park. You will not need a sticker to get down there, at least this year.
Okay.
Although the supervisor of South Cape Beach did want it to be known that they will be checking the beach on a regular basis and all the rules and regulations that apply at the other beaches, no open fires, no alcohol, no major parties,
yeah.
will still be in effect there.
Okay. Jeff Spillane is a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise, and you can follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Spillane, and that's GeoffSpillane. Thank you, Jeff.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome. Our pleasure. And Nelson Siegelman is on the phone, and he's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
So Oak Bluffs is getting back into the debate about whether to have fluoride in its water.
Yes, this is interesting. It's one of those debates when it begins anew, you think, wasn't that settled some time ago? But apparently one of the members of the Oak Bluffs Board of Health wanted to revisit the issue, and John Campbell, he's a staunch opponent of fluoridation. Fluoridation in Oak Bluffs began in 1991, and he's raised the issue, so the Board of Health held a hearing on Tuesday morning, but very few people attended, which I suppose is not unusual on a Tuesday morning, and the Board of Health decided they need to hold another hearing in order to get more public opinion, and then depending on what they hear, they're talking about bringing it up at a town meeting. But the question really is whether or not they're going to continue to fluoridate the water. Mr. Campbell highlighted a number of ill effects caused by fluoridation, including elevated levels of a type of bone cancer. But in the story, reporter Barry Stringfellow spoke with Dr. Bruce Donoff. He's the dean of the Harvard School of Dental Medicine. He made no bones about it. He said the fluoridation is one of the greatest public health measures, I'm quoting, that we've ever had in this country. So I suppose we'll be reporting more on this, and we'll have an opportunity to examine the benefits and the whatever ill effects people claim are from fluoridation.
Right. Ann Brennan?
Well, Nelson, as I understand it, Oak Bluffs is the only water supply that has fluoride in it on the island?
Of the three municipal water supplies on the vineyard, they're the only town that adds fluoride.
So have they looked at to see within Martha's Vineyard if there's a difference between people who have fluoride in their water, live in areas where fluoride is, and live in other areas?
Yeah, I suppose that would be the result of a public health study, and I don't know of anything that's ever anything like that, although, the dentists here certainly speak in favor of fluoridation. And there's a question, why don't the other towns do it? And as a follow-up, we're going to be looking at that question because I'm curious why the only Oak Bluffs adds fluoride. So there are still questions to follow up, and that's why they have us here, right?
Excellent. Right. That's right. That's exactly right. There's another good story in the paper this week about Oak Bluffs and eyesores there. Folks can go to the Martha's Vineyard Times website to read that and all the stories in the paper this week. Nelson Siegelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and he joins us on the Roundup each week. Thank you, Nelson.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Ann Brennan here in our Woods Hole studio. We've been following this story about the Orleans Board of Health chairman, and another member of that committee there had run into some problems when they said some things into an open microphone.
Right. This was last month. David Currier is a new member of the board who had been elected. This happened at a Board of Health meeting, and he had been elected the day before. He was at his first meeting, and they were going to consider an issue that involved a restaurant. And so Job Taylor III and Augusta McCusick, who were both board members, said he asked if he Currier if he was going to recuse himself. And Currier said, no, I own a bowling alley. But they said, you serve food and alcohol there. And they pretty much demanded that he leave the room.
That always, I haven't been able to get my mind around that, because one of the primary things the Board of Health does is deal with food issues.
Right.
So essentially they were looking to this gentleman to recuse himself from, I don't know what percentage, a very large percentage of the discussions they would have going forward.
Right. And but after he left the room, according to a video of this of the meeting, it appeared that Taylor leaned over to McCusick and appeared to refer to Currier as a son of a bitch.
Oh, I probably would have advised you not to have said that, but
okay,
yes.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
We had it in our paper. That's what he said.
That's okay.
You know, and he said he was an SOB because he declined to recuse himself. There was some conversation that continued between the two before people in the audience said, you know, this is being recorded. And after that meeting, there was a big outcry of this kind of uncivil behavior. And so Selectman got involved and voted unanimously to ask Taylor and McCusick to step down. McCusick did last week, and Taylor did as of Tuesday.
Okay. Let's move on to this issue about Narcan. We've talked about Narcan. That is a drug that can be administered to someone who is overdosing on opiates, heroin in particular, and bring them essentially back to life, bring them out of it pretty instantaneously. And around the Cape, we've been seeing people, regular folks, trained, people who have addicts in their lives, trained how to use this, take it home. But now, great story in the Cape Cod Times about police officers having trouble getting trained to use this because of regulations.
Right. And a few months ago, Governor Deval Patrick declared an emergency the public health emergency because of the number of overdoses that are happening statewide. And in his declaration, he put $20 million to, helping people, prevention and addiction recovery. But also, this was meant to expedite getting Narcan in the hands of local police so that if they come across somebody who's OD'd, they can administer the drug. It's a nasal. It's administered through the nasal passage. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that the State Department of Public Health rules or recommendations are that each department have a medical director to oversee the training, to issue the Narcan, and basically oversee the program. The problem is nobody wants to do this job on Cape Cod from essentially. Cape Cod Healthcare says that they can't. The Bunchable County EMS Emergency Medical Services says that they can't do it. In the meantime, there are departments that have just gone ahead, like Falmouth and Mashpee got the training, and they've just gone ahead and issued the Narcan to their police officers. In Provincetown, the Cape Cod AIDS Support Network, which trains civilians, has trained the Provincetown Police, and they're acting as their medical director. But for other departments, they're waiting to kind of follow the rules and have not been able to get a medical director in place.
Go ahead, more.
There is talk that the head of the medical director for the Barnstable County Correctional Facility may become the medical director for Cape Cod, but that looks like it's still in the works.
Oh, yeah. The sheriff over there has been really heavily involved in the issue of overdoses and the drug scourge on the Cape and the islands, of course. And one final, we have 30 seconds here, but one final story. In today's paper, shark numbers are going up, great white shark numbers, and we're not too surprised.
Right. Well, this is based on historical data of about 200 years worth of eye contact sightings. And it's the first significant research in 40 years. And it does appear that the shark population has been growing since the 1997 ban on U.S. shark landings.
Right. And Doug Frazier has a story about that with some great detail and some wonderful quotes from Greg Skomel, the state biologist. So folks can go to Cape Cod Online to read that story in today's paper. Also, the World Cup began this week, and Don Cuddy is doing a piece about that on Mondays for us here on WCAI. He's also doing a column for the New Bedford Standard Times. You can catch up on your World Cup information in a couple places there. Thank you, Ann Brennan, the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Cod Times and Cape Cod Online.
Thank you, Sean.
An exciting roundup as usual. And you can follow Ann on Twitter at AnnBrennanCCT. Thanks to the other contributors, of course, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.